Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, we're back, and it's hot. I just want to start by saying that it's hot. Not that I need to tell you that. It's going to be a little hotter than normal, but it's the Gulf Coast summer that we all need. Whether you want it or not, we all need it. It's good for you. Good for you. Get out and enjoy it as much as you can. It's interesting. We are not under a heat alert in the Mobile area, even though areas that are getting equally hot in Mississippi are under a heat alert. I never quite understand that. I guess that means that people in Mississippi aren't used to heat. That ain't right. I don't know. But, you know, it's going to be 111 is the heat index. That's a funky number over in Huntsville. You can believe it or not. It's sort of a good number, sort of a not so good number. 107, more like the heat index around Mobile. Hattiesburg, excuse me, 111. So it's interesting times, good times, and everybody's trying to figure out what to do about heat, and most people just stay inside, lock themselves inside. It's interesting. And I always remember, and I think, you know, God, it's so odd for people now to even think about being in the heat. Yeah, Keith says they love to sweat over in Mississippi. And so, you remember when you went to school? I don't know. Some of you don't remember. I remember my last year of school in Alabama, in high school. I remember that, boy, I was ready to get out of there in every way. I was listening to my teacher read the book every day when we came to class. That was the teaching. Lord have mercy, help us. And just read from the book. I mean, if people couldn't read in the 12th grade, they were, you know, maybe they needed to have the book read to them. The bigger issue was is that nobody could possibly pay attention to her droning. Except, you know, it would get even worse on those days when we didn't have air conditioning. And in August and September, we had a heat index of 105. And they would blow the fans through the windows as much as they could. You had big fans in the room, do you remember? And we all just sort of accepted that that was the way life was. Nobody thought it was any different. Except it wasn't much fun to listening to the teacher drone on, and perhaps even less fun when she was droning on during that kind of heat. Not teaching you anything, not even really purporting to teach you anything, except how to memorize the answers to a very dumb, inconsequential test. So we're doing all this, and I'm thinking, how do I deal with this? I'm hot. I don't want to be here. So every time I get hot, I think about that schoolroom, and I think about how hot it was that day, and I think about how it was kind of normal. We kind of accepted it. We were all going to live with it. We all did. We weren't particularly adept at dealing with heat, any of us. There were, what, 35 people in that class of all different grades of stamina and being used to heat, and they all survived it. But how did you survive it? One of the ways I remember surviving that kind of heat and that kind of boredom with the heat was to remember to imagine I was someplace else. It was really cool. So I remember writing a little piece in my senior year, still have it somewhere, about what it felt like when snow started when it began to snow. And I'm sitting there in that room, which had to have been 97 degrees in the shade, no heat index. Even for those of us who are used to being in the South, unlike people nowadays who have no idea what it's like living in the South, even when they live here, it was unbearable. And I suddenly started thinking about snow tapping on the window, almost without a sound. And then I thought about, how do you know it's snowing in the woods? Because it's just, in fact, when snow happens, and I don't get to see snow that much, I'll tell you, I'm from the South. But when I've seen it, it's just amazing, because when you see that snow is just, it feels, but it's, you would think there was some sound, but there's no sound. It's almost the absence of sound that makes you realize the snow has come. It was the utter silence and awe of the woods and the presence of the snow. Amazing to think about that. Amazing to think about how close you had to sit to the fire to get warm after you come in from being in the snow without all the clothes that you need to be in the snow. Your feet are wet. Your fingers are wet because you don't have really good gloves, and you just want to sit so close to the fire. And, you know, by the time I was through writing that piece, I didn't hear the teacher, thank goodness. I didn't feel the heat. And a lot of times when I get hot, I just think about, what is that? What's it like when snow fills up the woods? It's one way to do it. So I'm going to tell you something else. It's that time of year in this heat when it's time for you to start thinking about winter vegetables. Yes, you want a great antidote to heat? You want the best antidote to heat? Let's start thinking about winter vegetables, because now is the time when we have to start thinking about what are our winter gardens going to look like? What are we going to be eating out of those winter gardens? Now, there's lots of cool stuff coming in, and there's lots of cool things you can do. It's time to start those peppers, folks. I could do a whole show on starting peppers. I start my peppers this time of year. I start them in pots, keep them over winter in pots, but it can be a big advantage with some peppers, not your Mexican peppers. Don't worry about those. Start them in spring, as usual. But the really good peppers, the ajis, I start them right about now. But you know what else? I'm also ordering seeds like crazy. I'm ordering as fast as I can before I do a show on ordering seeds and then have you guys all order the seeds out from under me. I'm ordering seeds. I got to get parsley. Parsley, man. I got to get that ready to go very soon. I'm rethinking broccoli. We could talk about broccoli for the rest of the show. I'm happy to talk about the broccoli varieties I'm looking at. Some really new ways of thinking about broccoli. Cabbages. You know, Johnny down in Grand Bay, Johnny just does it like he's falling out of bed. It's hard. Cabbages are hard for me. I don't get them right. I don't get them right for, I don't know, how many different reasons I don't get them right. But I start mine from seed. I got some varieties now I'm very happy with. They're doing much better. Going to talk. Oh, man, I've got to get those. I got to get them. You know, I haven't ordered them yet. So as soon as I get through with this show, I'm going to beat you to ordering those cabbages. Because it's hard to find seeds sometimes this year. You better get to it early. Collards. Man, have I got some great collards that I'm really excited about. I am just, I've kind of settled on collards. I've really changed my mind about how I look at collards and what they do and the varieties I grow. And I can tell you a little bit about that, too. We can talk about carrots. It's about time to start thinking about how we're going to do carrots. Carrots can be a little tricky. They can be tricky, there's no question, particularly in wet soils where the water tables are high. But, you know, in fall, the water table drops, and the carrots are pretty good. They can be pretty good. You're going to have to figure out how to sow them, get them ready to go. I'm always coming up with inventive ways. Beets, if you're going to do beets. Garlic, folks. You got to start thinking about garlic right now if you're going to do garlic. A lot of people were very happy with their garlic. Some people were not as happy because they couldn't find the right varieties because they waited too late. You got to think about garlic right now. It's really the time of year. Radishes. Oh, my goodness. we got to do something about radishes. We got to have the radishes ready to go. I hope you're writing all this down, because these are the kinds of things you think about when it's hot in the middle of July and in August. You think about those cooling winter crops, because if you don't start them now, you ain't going to get them done. Hey, we're going to be back. We're going to answer your questions. Hold on, Grandma. We're going to be right back.
The fair is blue, the mountain knows. Is not an iris or
a... Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Rain, rain on my face. Hasn't stopped raining for days. My world is a flood.
Okay, welcome back. Alabama Sunday morning, Mississippi Sunday morning. Hey, hi. Sunday. But a good day to begin and thinking about I'm really in early and really up and ready over. I want it to be able to totally replace basil. Totally replace basil. And the basil's gonna, you know, basil's gonna kind of tweak out in November. So I want good sizable plants. Broccoli's the same way. You know, you got to wait for it to flower. That's what you're eating is flowers. If people don't think they ought to eat flowers, well, you better quit eating figs. Stop eating figs right now because you're eating a flower. It ain't a fruit. Not if you grow it in the Gulf Coast. Not if you grow it in Alabama or Mississippi. It's just a flower. We can talk about it. You just call me. We'll talk about figs. But it's a good time to be thinking about these plants, because you got to get the broccoli up big enough so that it starts flowering before the days get too short. Same with cabbages. So you got to start them now, pretty soon. It's definitely time to order the seed, so I'm giving you plenty of time to do it. I'd love to talk about, and while we're thinking about it, we might rethink broccoli, because broccoli's one of these funky things. You know, you find a good variety of broccoli that works well for the Gulf Coast, and what they're going to do is they're going to take it off the market because it doesn't work well in Boston. So it's always, you're always having to find, rethink broccoli, and I've rethought broccoli in several different ways, and I think there's some really, really important new ways of thinking about broccoli that are probably better for us on the Gulf Coast. We'll have time to talk about them, but if you feel like you need to talk about them today, well, you just call me. We'll talk about it. Honey Grand in Baldwin County. Honey Grand, do I call you that?
Yes, please do. My grandchildren call me that and name me that.
All right, good, good. So what's up?
All right, I have two questions for you. Since it's so hot and I've already gone to other seasons in my mind, do sweet peas grow in Baldwin County? And if they do you have any special tips for me? And tell me some winter herbs. I already and my parsley is still growing. I've already harvested my crop 3 times of all my herbs, because they're expensive nowadays, and they just do beautifully here. So those are my questions.
So, so should I start backwards? Let's start backwards. Let's go with the winter herbs first. Because, you know, it's interesting. Most herbs that people think about, all of them grow better during winter than they do during summer. The exceptions are few. Basil is one. Basil grows better during the summer. Rosemary is kind of an exception because it grows all year long. But sage, thyme, parsley, marjoram, those conventional herbs, they're all cilantro. They're all going to grow much better during winter than they do during summer.
Okay.
What, name well, some other herbs
herb
that you
I
would
lost
like.
Was basil.
To grow. I'm going.
Hey. Did I lose you too?
Well, so let's talk about your basil.
It's gone.
During
I'm not
summer.
Dealing with it now.
I'm surprised that you were able to keep sage alive. That's rare.
And my parsley's doing fabulous.
Yes.
And I have oregano and thyme and parsley and rosemary, and they're all doing great.
Yeah. So that's unusual. I am shocked because I can't keep them alive. You may not be able to keep them alive into September, but they actually will do better. Almost all of them will do better if you seed them in fall and let them grow over the winter. All of them are winter hardy along the Gulf Coast. There may be a few exceptions. Some of the marjorams may not be, but they'll do much better if you start them in fall and let them grow over winter and then give up on them in late July and August. It may be if you alive through the summer, that's pretty exceptional. I mean, that's like 1 in 1,000. So you're really good at doing something that the rest of us haven't figured out, and it may be that there were some conditions this summer that helped that to happen. At least that's true on the Gulf Coast. So most of those will grow really well. Now, your basil, we need to figure out what went wrong with your basil, but I will say that basil is very subject to a lot of diseases, and that you have to get the right varieties of basil. And there's a great one, and I'll tell you, it's my favorite. It's called Obsession.
Okay.
Obsession. And that's easy enough to remember, I think. It was produced by Rutgers. And it's resistant to the major diseases that are affecting basil right now.
Okay.
So it's a really good basil. So I don't think you'll have that problem. It doesn't go to seed very easily either, which makes it really easy. And it could be something you're doing wrong, but you're doing everything else right with these other herbs, so I think that's not it. I think you probably had... Did the basil get kind of blackened leaves?
Yeah. Look,
the leaves started... Yeah. Yeah, so it's basil downy mildew, and so Obsession's completely resistant to it. It's why I recommend it. It just would have been a good year. So there it is, your herbs. And, you know, it's interesting. If you're going to do summer herbs, I think about things like gingers. Ginger's a great herb for summer. It does great. Basil can do great if you grow the right varieties. I love a lot of the Mexican herbs that people forget about. Papalo is one of my favorites, P-A-P-A-L-O. And its relatives are really nice, and they grow really well during summer. So it's a whole... You have to go to another place. You don't go to European herbs during summer. You go to Asian and... You go to Asian and Central American and South American herbs during summer. And there's some really great stuff out there that's a lot of fun to grow. But for those European herbs, most of them do better when planted in fall. So there's your herb thing. Everything's going to be, you could almost, any herb you could name that's a common herb that you can buy in the store in a can is going to do better over winter, except for perhaps basil.
All right, thanks.
Now, that brings us back to this thing about sweet peas, right? And so, yes, sweet peas, let's be careful. Sweet peas are not the edible peas. They're the flowering peas that have such great scent.
Yeah, no, I want the flowering that go on fences.
That's right. So, so, yes, they do grow in Baldwin County. They are another overwintering plant, though. You don't plant them in summer. You plant your seeds in September, October. If you want to be careful about it, you can plant them in pots, in containers, start them inside in a moist place or on a porch is a great place to start them. Get those seedlings up in a little container, nice size container, not too big, but not too small either. And then about the time they've developed their first true leaves, You know, they'll get that first little set of leaves, mm-hmm. and then they'll get another set. That's what we call true leaves. That second set of true leaves, plant them out on your fence, and they'll do great. They'll grow, they'll develop. They won't die in the winter. There's a lot of varieties that I have tried. You know, and I think almost all of them are going to survive on the Gulf Coast. Some of them bloom earlier than others. Where would I go? There's a place called Renee's Garden Seeds, R-E-N-E-E, Renee, Renee's Garden Seeds. And I checked the other day in her website. No, it's you have to go on the internet.
Okay.
I'm sorry. You got to go on the internet, and it's Renee's Garden Seeds, and you can order seeds from them, and they have a lot of varieties of sweet peas that work well for us. Some of their old-fashioned ones are some of the best, but, you know, I think in Mobile and in Baldwin County, virtually all of them work. Some of them, I like the early-blooming ones best.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, we about talked this segment out, didn't we? We got 15 minutes of talk here.
Honey, you're talking to
Hold on. We're going to be right back in case you have any more questions.
That wasn't boring.
Yeah.
That surrounded me. The sun could never fall away. The bliss that plays around me. Let it rain. Let it rain.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Maybe it'll rain, maybe it won't, but it's going to be hot. So, Honey Gran, I hope I gave you enough to go on.
You did. You did.
And,
thank you so much.
Yeah.
And all my pots all my herbs are in pots. And to harvest them, you pick them, you put them on a cookie sheet. Take the stems and bake them for 1 hour, and then they're ready to be put in containers. So you saved yourself a whole lot of money.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So, and all that's good. And being in containers, a lot of those will do well. A lot of them will even do in the ground in winter here, but they'll do better in containers as long as they don't get extremely cold, which is very rare. The other one that I should have mentioned to you, and I'm trying to think through them all, lavender. We can grow lavender over winter here very well. So Spanish lavenders in particular are really nice. Now, and you can grow them in pots, but just make sure it's a nice big pot. If you'll have to grow them from cuttings, not seeds. But if you can find lavender plants this time of year, not English lavender, but Spanish lavenders and most French lavenders, they'll do really well. Lavender Provence, P-R-O-V-E-N-C-E.
Okay.
Provence is one of my favorites. And it does very well. I mean, I've tried a lot of other varieties, but that one just seems to work all the time. It'll do great over winter. It'll do terrible in July. It hates July. And particularly on the Gulf Coast.
I have to tell you this. My herbs are on a covered porch. They're in pots, and they're on the little things that hang over the side of the rail. And I have a double space. But I bring them in. I get up real early. And when it's real hot during the day, I bring them inside and put them on the counter. And then when it starts cooling down in the evening, I put them back out. So maybe
isn't that interesting? So you're really working. Well, it does help. Here's the interesting thing. They hate the night temperatures more than the day temperatures. So you may actually do better to bring them in at night into a cooler place. Isn't that odd? Because they need the sunlight during the day.
Well,
but it's true.
Now, so I don't know whether I should chance just changing it around or not. But my thing
well,
is
they
the
need
hot
the,
weather
they,
is I'm decorating my palm that's inside with Christmas ornaments. I get to put one on every time when it gets over 100.
Yeah. So remember that they need the sunlight during the day, and they're I've been to the places where they grow in Europe, like in Andalusia and southern Spain, and it gets very hot during the day there, extremely hot. I mean, into the hundreds. And they do just fine, thyme and sage, and mm-hmm. but the night temperatures cool off, and it stays dry. So it's the nights that are hardest on those. And so
right.
just remember, they need photosynthesis during the day, but those night temperatures are really tough on them.
Oh,
take
thank
a few and
so it, much.
See if it yes, see if it doesn't make a difference.
All right. I certainly will. Thank you very much for your
thank
expertise.
You.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am. All right. Well, it is an important thing. I'm not sure not sure that one. I stuck that landing very well. But let me tell you, it is generally really important. And if you're thinking about plants and what hurts plants this time of year, your tomatoes don't quit doing. It's not so much the daytime temperatures. Our daytime temperatures don't get that high. I mean, think about it. If you're in, particularly on the Gulf Coast, if we get daytime temperatures in the mid-90s, it's just wild. It's exceptional. People in the northern part of the state, central part of the state, people in Montgomery, they get those high temperatures all the time. Much more often than we do, actually. So, and certainly people in Arizona get those kind of high temperatures, and Texas and Dallas, where the ground cracks, according to Mike, cracks in Alabama too. They get really high temperatures during the day. Washington, D.C., really high temperatures. We do not get high temperatures during the day. The difference on the Gulf Coast is that our night temperatures don't drop. And we're getting into that phase when night temperatures don't drop below 75 degrees. Let me tell you something about plants and respiration. Most plants from Europe can tolerate relatively high daytime temperatures if the nighttime temperatures drop, because there's this thing called respiration and photosynthesis, and they exhaust themselves trying to respire at night in really hot temperatures. So if you wanted to go to this much trouble and keep herbs alive, for example, or keep your tomatoes alive, can't imagine doing this, but if you could take that tomato that was outside and take it inside at night or your herbs, it would make all the difference. It would make all the difference because it doesn't know it's inside, because it doesn't get photosynthesis at night anyway. It gets the photosynthesis, which is how it feeds itself, during the day outside, tolerates those high temperatures, doesn't like the humidity particularly, but tolerates the high temperatures. You bring it inside and let it cool off at night so that it doesn't lose as much of its energy to what scientists call respiration, respiring activities, and it'll do amazingly well. Now, that's a lot of trouble, but it's something really important to understand. It's not the daytime temperatures on the Gulf Coast, which are not that high. It's the nighttime temperatures. If it feels hot to you, and let's be careful in case you want to argue. If it feels hot to you, it's because of the humidity. It's not because of the temperature, right? Because our daytime temperatures are just not that high. Important thing to think about. I don't know. It's sort of square one for understanding life on the Gulf Coast. It's an important thing, important thing. All right, Patrick. Patrick's up next. I'm here. I'm listening. What's up?
Oh, last year I saved my seed from my trombone chino squash, but none of them sprouted. So I had to use seed that I had bought, you know, the year before. And I was wondering if you could tell me how to properly save the seed.
Well, that's an interesting thing. I can't tell you. It should be pretty easy to save tromboncino seed. How many plants of tromboncino did you grow when you saved the seeds?
Six.
Yeah. Well, that's probably enough to get some seeds to germinate, so I'm not quite sure why. Now, I will tell you that you're really going to have to let those big things mature. And when they mature, they're going to be about, they're going to be the size of a trombone, right?
Right.
Did you know that?
Well, yeah. I've seen pictures.
How big were your...
That may be where I messed up. I picked it at the stage where I would have eaten it, like about 16 inches long. So I may need to just leave one vine to get big, maybe.
We got it figured out. We got it figured out. So there it is. Ideally, you'd want about 12 plants. That would be ideal. I don't know why people like the number 12, but that's kind of a good number. But more than a half dozen is okay, but you probably want just a few more plants, maybe 10 plants to save from to make sure that you get a good diversity of plants. But if you can make that much room, it's probably good, but you're going to have to let them mature. So it would be like... Well, the fruit just isn't mature. So we eat tromboncino. One of the things I recommend is that we eat them immature, like summer squash, but the fruits are immature. They're not ready to, so those seeds are really thin. They're not, you notice how much thinner they were than the ones you planted? So
yeah, I did notice that.
Yeah, so what you want them to do is plump out. They'll get a little fatter, the seeds will, but the fruit will be huge. I mean, it will be astonishing. It will be something you would want to try to figure out, how do I incorporate this into a Halloween costume? Because it's just going to be like, I mean, and it's just amazing how big those fruits are. They're trombones, tromboncino, when they're mature. And you can eat them when they're mature, too. I don't quite like them as much as some others, but they're good. And if you ask David Hubble would figure out how to make something really good out of tromboncino. But when it's mature, but you got to let them mature. So there it is. That's it. I don't know, and you don't want to. You don't have to. You let those fruits start maturing when you get tired of eating the young ones. So when you get tired of eating the young ones, you let some of the other ones mature into fall, and just let them go to seed, as we say, by letting those fruits mature. So there it is. That's the key.
Okay. Do I let just one or two of the squash go mature, or do I need to do more?
So you've asked a great question. It would be ideal to pick, if you have a dozen plants, it would be ideal to pick, I would say, six fruits. Some people would want to do a little bit more, but that's probably about right. So, but pick from, if you've got six plants, save three fruits, and then mix those seeds up from different plants, three fruits from different plants. You see what I'm saying? And pick your best three plants, the one that were most productive, the ones that looked the best, and did best over the whole season, and save the seed from three different fruits off three different plants. At the rate you're going, and then just mix those seeds up so you don't know which one is which, and then plant them out. And those seeds will last a pretty good long time, particularly inside in air conditioning. They'll last for several years, I would bet, maybe 4 years, 5 years. So there it is.
All right. Hey, let me tell you this, Bill.
Yes, sir.
I'm pulled off on the side of the highway where I have a good signal, and I didn't even plan on this, but there's a small field that hadn't been mowed all summer. And I thought about what you talk about, you know, leaving an area not mowed, and it is just, there's thousands of dragonflies and bees and butterflies in it. And then the lot next to it has been mowed, and there's just nothing there. And it's just really neat, as I was talking to you. I mean, there's stuff everywhere in this waist-high, overgrown field.
Patrick, that is so good to hear. That is so neat to hear. And that is so clearly what we see all over Alabama. What a beautiful thing. Patrick, thank you.
All right.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Lots of things I'm trying to figure out. Somebody sent me a picture of a foxtail grass. It is indeed foxtail. Most of the foxtails that we see, in Alabama, foxtail grasses, they have a funny little thing. That one's almost certainly a European foxtail, or maybe the Japanese foxtail. But there is a great foxtail that grows in the marshes in Greene County and in Mobile County. It's just beautiful. It's gigantic, and it's a beautiful thing, and it's blooming about this time this year, but you only really see it in marshes. Most of the other foxtail grasses we see are, they're invasive. They've jumped in for various reasons, and they can kind of look, they can look interesting at times. They can be a little bit invasive. So, the reason I said David could give us a recipe is that I think a lot of recipes, like David is suggesting, is that tromboncino recipes could be similar to gugusa, which David makes a lot of. David does some really good things. David's pictures, I get to see David's pictures all the time. You don't get to see David's pictures all the time. David Hubble sends his pictures in of his growing things, except he posted them to Facebook. And because of that, David won a planting wheel. Not that I'm sure he needs one anymore. He's got it down. But the goodness of his heart, he was the winner of the Facebook contest this week. And you can be a winner next week, too, by submitting your pictures to our Facebook page, FM Talk 106.5. You can kind of look that up on Facebook in the ways that you look things up on Facebook. And you've been right on that Facebook page, and you can submit your pictures, and you can be voted the winner of our contest. That's a thing. We do it. We have it. If you have pictures that you want me to diagnose on the show today, don't send it to Facebook. Send it directly to me, and we'll figure out what it is. But if you just want to win that contest and you want to share with others how pretty your garden is, or what a neat thing you have seen, you can post it to Facebook. Cool thing. So David says with his gugusa, for example, he lets it get as big as possible and kind of lets it dry out. He's right. And that's just one way to think about it. You really want the fruit to begin to dry on the stem, at least the top of it. You'll notice it drying out. You'll notice it drying out where the fruit connects to the vine. You'll notice it beginning to sort of dry out there. You know it's mature then. So if you're saving your tromboncino seeds, you really want it to get big, but you really want it to dry out as well. Patrick, it was so nice to hear from you about that, about those open areas. Mobile is, the Gulf Coast is one of those places where dragonflies are just really abundant. And bees are really abundant of all kinds, at least in native habitats. And we benefit, even in urban areas from the marshes and other things that are around us because those dragonflies just come in. But it's getting rarer and rarer to see some of the dragonflies because we treat our pastures like golf courses. Don't do that. If you've bought a big piece of ground, I don't know what you call big, 5 acres, 3 acres, 2 acres, don't tell me it's natural and then mow the whole thing. There ain't nothing natural about that. And you've participated. I'll pause before I say this. If you've got 5 acres and you're mowing it every summer so that it looks like a golf course, you've participated in a major way in the destruction of things that are beautiful about the Gulf Coast. You've participated in the destruction of our dragonflies. You've participated in the destruction of our wildflowers, the things we talk about. Don't do that. Don't do that. There's no need. There's no need. And I don't want to make you mad. I just feel it. I mean, it just hurts me to see it, because I know that what we have on the Gulf Coast is so beautiful and so valuable. And I mean valuable. Valuable in ways that we've never even begun to contemplate how valuable it can be. Hyper diversity, hyper beauty, like, it's just not, you don't find it anywhere else. Literally. You can find other good things in other places. But in North America, it's rare to find anything like the diversity we have along the Gulf Coast. I don't know. Maybe you believe it's just an accident that you got all this here. And it's an accident, and it doesn't matter since it's an accident. But if you believe that God had anything to do with this, wouldn't you be careful about just mowing it down? I just wonder about that. Let's see, all these other things. Josh, you know, I got to figure out what's going on with your, there's something definitely going on with your citrus. It's hard for me to tell exactly. I think it's in the roots. I hope it's not in the ground in terms of, did you use a herbicide around this plant? But I think that it is in the planting and in the roots. Josh, you better call me. Let's talk about when you planted this thing. Because I think there's something going on in the roots. As yellow as it is, it ain't good. The mulch is probably not helpful, not quite right in the right place. So call me. Let's think about it, Josh. Something is going wrong there. Michael asked me about, do it yourself seed tape for planting carrots. Here's my thought about the seed tape. Seed tape is when you know you're going to get good germination, and you know you don't want to have to weed, you don't want to have to thin them, and you know that nothing's going to eat your seedlings, and so you're going to have the ultimate spacing, boom, 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 boom. Here's the problem. There's lots of things that can get seedlings. And lots of things that can eat those young seedlings. And there's many reasons why germination can be uneven. I don't think that seed tape works as well as you would like. I think it's better to thin. And I've come to this realization after many years of trying various versions of seed tapes and my own little seed tapes and everything else. I think it's better to thin. So sow the seeds. And there's also something about seed tapes is that they tend to dry out sooner. So what you've got to do is with carrot seeds, you've got to keep them moist. You don't want to bury them too deep. That's a big problem. But I don't think seed tapes work well. And I don't think do-it-yourself seed tapes work well. Now, you can pre-germinate those seeds, and I'll come back and talk a little bit about that. And I think it may help to do that if you can do it right. And I'll talk a little bit about how to do that. The broccoli seeds. So, Ellen, I will, if you'll just wait till after church to order. That is perfect. Thank you. I will talk about broccoli seeds. When we come back, we got to have a little news break.
Won't take long. Sing it right.
It's Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast with Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
All right, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Couple of things to begin thinking about. First off, Ellen, you know, Ellen's got to get to church. And she may have listened to this after church, but just in case I catch her on her way, Ellen, let's talk about broccoli, because that's how we got started, right? I said it's time to start thinking about cool things. In the middle of the heat, we start thinking about cool things and having them ready to go. There are a lot of conventional broccolis out there, and I know, Ellen, you've tried several of them. I remember, because I know you tried the Brazilian broccoli, persicaba. I forget where Portuguese put their persicaba, I think, which is a persicaba. Who knows? I don't speak Portuguese. It's a great little broccoli from Brazil. It's a really neat one, and I know you've grown that one. There's I've tried a lot of others broccolis that are now no longer available, because that's what happens when you start growing hybrids. They're not available sometimes, and the hybrids offer a lot of advantages because they start producing early, and they can be nice. I am going to go back to some of the old Italian broccolis, like De Chico. I think I've kind of got the Italian sort of halfway down so that people understand what I'm saying. De Chico, don't speak Italian either. What are some of the others? I'll think of some of the others. But here's what I wanted to get to. There are some new and old types of broccoli. There is Asian broccoli, which is Kailan, which I really like. It's the flavor is very similar. It has an appearance similar to broccoli, except you tend to eat the leaves, and it produces very early. That's a big advantage for us. I also find that Kailan and its hybrids are also much hardier. So there are a lot of broccolis out there, some new ones out there that are hybrids between Asian broccoli and the Italian broccolis. And one is Asperbrock. I think the idea is that it is like asparagus, Asperbrock. And you know, I planted it without a lot of, I planted it late. It was really tough conditions, colder than it should have been. It was perfectly hardy. And I think it may even be hardier than, I'm pretty sure that it's hardier than most broccolis. It makes sense that it would be. And it produces very early, and it has a great flavor. Asperbrock, you'll see it. It's one of the hybrids. But Kailan in particular, K-A-I-L-A-N, you'll see it. G-A-I-L-A-N. There are a lot of varieties out there. There's so many, I haven't tried them all. But it's a new way of thinking about broccoli. And I really like them. I think they're really good for us. And, you know, grow some standard broccolis as well. Persicaba. I hope I said that right. Persicaba is a great one. The Italian ones are really good. There's some great hybrids out there, the F1s, that you have to combine two parents and grow one generation, and only some big seed house is going to offer it. You couldn't save the seeds from it. And they're all okay. But I'm liking this Kailan and Kailan, and I'm going to put a lot more effort into it. Yod Fa was another one. That's a Chinese broccoli. Kitazawa Seeds. Look through Kitazawa Seeds and see what they have to offer. And you can go to Johnny's Select Seeds. I think they have Asperbrock and some of the others. Baker Creek certainly had Asperbrock, I believe. And you know who else? Territorial Seed had some great. I think Territorial Seed is probably where I got the Asperbrock. Apollo was another one that I grew. It's good. It's very good. It's one of these newer broccoli types that produces lots of small heads, which is the best thing for us. Produces them over and over and over throughout the winter. I didn't think Apollo did quite as well as Asperbrock. I didn't think it was quite as hardy. Maybe not quite as early. And then maybe not quite as tough. But there you go. Ellen, I hope that helped. Blue Wind, you know, Blue Wind, they quit producing it. They quit producing it. I can't find it. So Ellen is asking me, what about Blue Wind broccoli, which I used to recommend, and it was one of those F1 hybrids produced by some big seed house, and they decided, oh, I don't care what Ellen's growing down in Alabama. She ain't buying enough seeds for me to keep making them. I only care what people in Boston are doing. They quit growing Blue Wind. It's too bad. If you can find it, Ellen, you tell me. You know, another one, there were several varieties that I recommended, and they just quit growing them like all at once. Crazy stuff. Crazy stuff. Yeah, beautiful pictures. I'm pausing because David Bracken was got down to Splinter Hill. Good to hear from you, David. And he went to Splinter Hill, and it is absolutely stunning. You want to see what wildflowers look like. There is nothing like this picture anywhere else in the country. It is unbelievable. Unbelievable, the pitcher plants. So beautiful. Incredible right now. Good golly, if you mow this down. How could we be mowing this down the way we are? It's just crazy. But one of the most beautiful sights you've ever seen, David, is it not? This beautiful side of the pitcher plant bog at Splinter Hill right now. And the pitcher plants, the beautiful yellow flower that you sent me, David, is an orchid. It's Habenaria, Plantathera, Platanthera, I'm sorry. Ciliaris is what I believe it is. Plantathera, Ciliaris. The fringed yellow orchid, or the fringed orange orchid, whatever you like calling it. It's a beautiful orchid. Really an incredible thing growing in there. Just an absolutely beautiful thing. What a beautiful place to think about. All of the life that comes out of our native landscapes. All of the life. The dragonflies. The birds are just incredible. Birds you've never heard from or seen before, and they're beautiful sounds. Beautiful sounds. The pineland sparrow, the longleaf sparrow, whatever you want to call it, Bachman sparrow, Bachman sparrow, whatever you want to call it, just beautiful singing this time of year. Beautiful, beautiful songs out of those woodlands. The frogs, so many species of frogs, and all of them making these incredible sounds. The rain frogs making these bongo sounds. It's just incredible in those woods right now. And you know, it's amazing because you walk through these native woods, and unlike our nasty landscapes that we create around our house with our lawnmowers, there are no mosquitoes. It's craziness. Well, there are mosquitoes, but they don't bite. There's gajillions of varieties of mosquitoes out there at Splinter Hill, and you can go out, and they're not biting. There are no ticks. It's amazing. There are no red bugs. It's amazing. It's just this crazy place full of insects, and none of them really out there to get you. It's just an amazingly beautiful place, our native landscapes. I want to think about the quail. The sounds of quail at Splinter Hill right now are just amazing. Ben was telling me about that the other day, about how he's noticed how many coveys of quail, how much he hears quail singing at Splinter Hill now that we've restored it, now that we've burned it, now that it's the native wildflowers. What a great place to be. What a great place to be. Splinter Hill this time of year. Josh! Oh, boy, I don't have time to answer. But, Josh, I think you've nailed it. I do think it's a little wet there, and I think the roots are rotting. We can talk about what to do about that. If you've recently planted it, I think if it's very recently planted, it's probably not too late and probably not a bad idea to move it because I think your area is getting very wet. It may not get that wet every year, but it will get that wet. It will get that wet some years. And when it does, it'll kill the plant. And that tangerine, I have some theories about it. We're going to be back to talk about it.
So many times that my memories are warm.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
we got to shut Led Zeppelin down because Derek's been waiting way too long. Derek, you still there?
I am, man. What's going on?
Good, good.
Can you hear me?
All right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I got you. I'm in my car. Sorry, I'm also choking on my own spit. Pollinators, man. We are just now starting to see, you know, any kind of bees. Not a whole lot of butterflies. I mean, it's, and, you know, our garden has pretty much got flooded out this year because all this dang rain. Is that normal? I mean, are we just now starting to see them or what?
Well, you just hit on it. Let's imagine you've got little bitty wings and you got to fly. And
yeah,
it's raining all the stinking time. So it's, so I do think, yeah. Yeah, I think that's been a big impact on butterflies. I'm sure it has an impact on bees. Our bees are a little better adapted to it, our native bees, and there are many kinds out there. I suspect you have had some. The little tiny bees, you know, some of the most important
bees.
Yeah,
we've seen those.
Yeah, yeah. And they're not, you know, they're kind of the classic Gulf Coast bees for summer because they do seem to be better at flying. And so they're not also rans, those little bees. They're probably the most important pollinators, certainly as important as bumblebees and carpenter bees, and probably more important than honeybees, certainly more important than honeybees. So it's good to see them, but the other bees probably having a hard time flying in all this rain.
Yeah, we saw actually this morning, you know, I saw some of the larger ones. The ones that I've seen, very few, very small, but just very, very few of them. And normally we've got a pretty big garden, and we let certain sides go for that native plant. I don't know if it's wild mint or whatever it is, but there's, you know, stuff we let go just to encourage them to feed. We've tried some wildflowers. So my second question is, we've got a pretty big, you know, little mini farm, and we're wanting just to let parts of it go. Should we plant any kind of certain flowers to kind of kickstart it? You know, I mean, you know, you got the big bags of, you know, pollinator mixes and all that. But like you always say, is that something for Boston? You know, we're wanting to give you an idea. We want, for the whole property, at least a half acre of wildflowers, just to make sure that, you know, we got plenty of bees and all of that.
Yeah, that'd be great. So the place to start is with what's wild and not with what you buy in a bag from Boston.
Yeah.
And I can guarantee you that there is no wildflower seed mix that is adapted for the Gulf Coast and that will do what you really want it to do, which is to survive and to serve as host for all of the native pollinators. So you got to kind of look to see what's in your field first. And I don't know what the history of your landscape is, but it probably has a lot of things that are just waiting to come up. It probably has a lot of invasive things in there that are waiting to come up too, like cogon grass. And so you have to kind of watch for that. But yes, I do think, here's what I would do. Start with what appear to be some of the most native areas where you're getting some wildflowers, and start there. You don't have to convert the whole field at once. But let's quit mowing there. Let's let it come up, and then you kind of let's walk through it. I'll walk through it with you. We'll look at the grasses. We'll look at the wildflowers. We'll see what's there. We'll figure out how to deal with them. We'll determine their value, whether they're native or not, and we'll just walk through it. And there'll be a lot of them, and they'll all be pretty cool. Some will be more valuable than others. But it'll be fun to do and fun to watch. So don't overwhelm yourself. You don't have to do the whole half acre at once.
You know, like I said, the rain, as with everybody, you know, even with our raised beds, I mean, complete washout. But then just looking at everything that's so far behind on any kind of, you know, flower development and, you know, just seeing, like, some flowers that are just coming out. And like, wow, man, it is concerning, you know. And a lot of people are asking, like, where the hell are the bees? So I guess,
well,
you know,
so
it is just that rain.
It's the rain, and I think it is the rain mostly. Now, it's not to say that we haven't seen a decline in bees, and we certainly have. And we've seen a decline, particularly in the native bees. It's much more important than the decline in honeybees. Honeybees don't play a big role in pollination, period. It's just that's the way it is on the Gulf Coast. They're there. They make great honey. I eat honey every day. I love honey. It's wonderful stuff. They don't play a big role in getting our stuff pollinated. It's the native bees, and when we get rid of all the native wildflowers, we get rid of the native bees. And so over a long term, we've seen a decline. And herbicides, mowing, I don't know which is worse. I think mowing's probably more important than herbicides in the decline in native bee populations. But we've seen that decline. However, this year, the big drop is really about the rain. You know, even things, you can look at blackberries. And it's fun to do. You can tell a lot about pollination by looking at blackberries. And if the blackberries are very short and they're not, and they're kind of stubby and they don't seem to be very well developed, it's because the flowers didn't get pollinated very well because it was raining too much. And that often happens in the middle of blackberry season, is it'll get too much rain and you get these little stubby blackberries that aren't very big. So pollination is it's a big deal, and for a lot of plants, not for every plant, and most plants in your garden don't need pollination. Tomatoes don't actually, they don't, peppers really don't, but things like okra do, and things like squash do, and so it's really important to have those pollinators. Melons.
It is. I mean, and then too, like you were saying, with the dragonflies and, you know, we've got several rabbits that we've been feeding all year, apparently. Just that ecosystem as a whole. We don't plan to mow. You know, we mow our path, but we're looking, just like I said, the natural thing. We hate herbicides. I mean, we might spray some neem on the plants, but besides that, you know, we try not to do anything that just will kill anything that we like. You know, we deal with a lot of pests, but, you know, it's just kind of part of it. You know, you got to give them some plants, and it's a balance for us. So, all right, so I shouldn't be too concerned. The world's not ending, right?
We're not because of that. There are other things, but not because of that. So, we do worry about the bees, but I think this year's drop is mostly about the rain. Next year's drop will be mostly about us. So,
one last quick question. Yeah. I'll let you get somebody else. Is there any kind of flower seeds I can throw down, you know, now to kind of just, you know, for to get like a quick boost for them? I mean, you know, any kind of
there
like
is
little...
nothing like those native mints. So when you're going, when you're driving down the road and you see those, you know, we needed a good name for them. They're called worst wrong name that I can think of, because they're pretty rare in the mountains. They're abundant in the coastal plain. They're abundant around Mobile. And there are all kinds of species. We have more species than any mountain does. But let's call them frosty mints, or frost mints, or snow mints, because you know what I'm saying. The tops of the leaves where the flowers emerge, they look like they're covered in frost or covered in snow when they're, it's just beautiful. They're those white topped mints. And they're about waist high to chest high right now, blooming along the roadsides. They are great. They're perfect. They're beautiful. They're native. And nothing that I can think of will attract more varieties of insects than those native mints, Pycnanthemum. Not the European mints, but those native mints, frosty mints, snow mints. You know what I'm talking about?
I think so. Well, I think so. We had this one that they were telling me it was a wild mint, and it grew with a purple top on it. And, I mean, there's videos where we let a 20x40 spot go, and bees, butterflies, you name it, you're just, even with the camera panned out, you see all of this activity. And it was amazing.
You better send me so that's not a mint. That's probably not a mint. Send me a picture of what you're talking about. None of the mints that I know of that are native have a purple top.
I will. I think it's maybe it's getting ready to bloom. I just left. So I'll send you a picture, because that
Oh, my God.
Send me a picture and let's talk about that.
I will.
Yeah.
All right, Bill.
So the pycnanthemums will be even better. Their blooms will be white, and they'll be at the top. I mean, there may be a little bit of purple on them, but not much. Just mostly white.
All right, yeah, I'll look for those. And so, as always, I love you. Thank you.
Thank you, Derek. Let's keep in touch.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Yeah, so Derek says, I'm contemplating this. I'm the Bob Ross of gardening. Of course, I'm alive, but which is one difference. There may be others. I won't be forever. Yeah, that's interesting. The Bob Ross of gardening. I'm working on that. gotta make me a shirt that says Bob Ross of gardening. That's something. Listen, Dan says his bumble and carpenter bee populations are doing just fine. And yeah, they're out there. You know, it is interesting. It is interesting to think where do bumblebees and carpenter bees live naturally. And sometimes the carpenter bees live in the siding of your home. I recognize that. Most bumblebees do not. The other day I had a little pile of hay that I was shoveling around and I heard it just, I stuck a little pitchfork into it and I heard this rumbling sound. It was like a colony of bumblebees. I don't know which one it was. They were in that hay. They were in the moldy part. They had loved it. They had a perfect little place there. And I said, you know, I better leave these guys alone. They don't attack you like honeybees do. But they, you know, I need them. So, I need them. I don't want to make them too mad because I want them to stay around. And so I didn't mess with that hay. And they produced their youngins and left. Little pieces of wood lying around the yard. Oh, boy. I'm nobody's favorite person because I advocate leaving little pieces of wood lying around the yard. But you know those little pieces of wood lying around the yard? You know what they're good for? Bees. Incredibly important homes for bees and lots of other things that are useful to your garden. They're in those little pieces of wood that fall. And, you know, sometimes it's bigger pieces mostly. Maybe the size of, you know, a little smaller than your wrists, but I think even things the size of your thumb can be useful habitat for a lot of things, even including bees. And those pieces of wood can be incredibly valuable as they begin to break down. And the other places that they're very valuable are bare spots of ground. And a lot of bees, like digger bees, incredibly important along the Gulf Coast. They don't like building when the ground is too saturated. So you may lose digger bee populations, and there's a lot of different kinds of digger bees. You may lose those digger bee populations in these very wet periods when it stays wet for a long period of time. So I suspect we've lost a lot of those. But Dan is right. A lot of them will just hang out waiting for things to improve. If they have to hang out too long, it ain't going to be good because they, you know, it's like they're foraging. This is their job. It's like, you know, if you have to stay home too many days from work, you don't get a lot of work done. And you may not get paid if you're getting paid by the hour, which bees get paid by the hour, basically. If you want to think about it that way, they ain't on a salary. If they ain't out working, they ain't making any money. Some of us are like that. Makes you feel any sympathy for the bees. So I think these rains can reduce the populations a bit.
grass.
What else have I got to talk about? What kind of grass is that? Scott sent me a picture of a grass. It's actually, Scott, not a grass. It's up around Citronelle. No, I'm sorry. It grows naturally in Georgetown, Chinchula area. Three left natural good. So these are things called sedges, as nearly as I can tell, and I'm pretty sure. And one of the old, which are not grasses, actually, sedges are maybe older than grasses. I think they may be. I'll have to think about it. I'll have to research it, actually. But sedges are slightly different things than grasses. So we curse a lot of sedges. So, you know, like that grow in our lawns that have those little weird little heads on them. Cypress and all kinds of sedges grow, and this is a sedge, and you can tell a sedge, as the botanists like to say, sedges have edges. Grasses are, there's another rhyme that I forget, but sedges have edges, and if you'll feel down around the base, you'll feel these sharp little squared off little sections of the stem. The stems are almost square. They'll definitely have some geometry to them. Most grasses, they may be flattened, they may be rounded, but they don't have those sharp, geometric, square-like edges around the base. But that's a sedge. Which sedge? Any taxonomist will be sympathetic to me when I say, I don't know. Because until we see some flowers, and until we see the fruits on those flowers, a bunch of sedges out there. But it's a sedge, and I think it's a native one. Seems to be a native one, given the height. I we'll have to see it in flower to see what kind it is. Scott, you can send me some pictures when it is in flower. You know, somebody sent me a picture of a tangerine, a so-called tangerine. Tangerine, here's the tough part, because their helpful neighbor told them it was a tangerine. Tangerine's a grocery store word, literally. It's best to understand tangerine is nothing but a grocery store word. It was a word devised by grocery stores. You think I'm making this up. Don't think I'm making this up, because it's the way the world works. Grocery stores devised a term to describe a host of different fruits that they thought would have some that they thought would have some marketability, and it was tangerine. And tangerine can mean a lot of different kinds of fruits, but generally it refers to small orange fruits and that are sold in grocery stores. Now, which variety of that is, I don't know. So referring to a plant as a tangerine is not helpful. But let me tell you, a lot of plants that are sold as tangerines, some of my favorites, they're really cool, but they're not that hardy. And we had a hard winter this past winter, and it's particularly tough along the Gulf Coast for a lot of citrus. And I think what I'm looking at is winter damage. Now I can tell some other stuff's going on. There's some herbicide that looks like it was applied around the plant, right where the meter is. There may have been some digging there. The soil is not great. It's terrible. But I think the roots are probably okay growing under the house, unless somebody's been chopping the roots off under the house. So if you've been chopping the roots anywhere within about a 10 to 15 radius, 15-foot radius, I could blame it on that. But I think I'm going to blame it on the cold, and I'm going to say it's a variety of citrus that is not as hardy. And that could be the old Dancy, the variety called Dancy, D-A-N-C-Y, which was one of my favorites. It was the classic tangerine that people used to get in their stockings. And if it is, it's a valuable tree. I really love it. It's great. But it's not very hardy. It would do fine around Fort Morgan most years. I think that's what happened. So I'm going to attribute that to hardiness. What do you do about it? Well, nothing really. I mean, it'll recover on its own. It's got plenty of growth. It's coming back. You can gradually trim out some of those broken branches if you don't like the ugliness of it. You can call me back and we can talk about how to do that. Ted, that mushroom you're showing me I'm pretty sure it is a bulbous at the base. It's a beautiful, highly toxic mushroom. It's one of the Amanitas, I think. I'll have to look it up to see which one it is, but that little, everything about it, toxic. It's a beautiful thing. It's a wonderful thing. You don't have to eat everything in the world, and you don't want to eat that one. That's for sure. But it doesn't hurt anybody just being there. Great work underground. It's a fine thing to have. I'll look at it and we'll see if I can figure out which one. So I've got it all up. I'm listening. Tell me about your quince. Oh, nothing. Hello. All right. Anybody there?
No callers.
No callers. No. Okay. Good. So let's go back to John in Irvington. John sent me a text asking about some wild passion flower in Tillman's Corner. You know, there's two types of native passion flowers that we see. One is the blue, and there's a purple one that's not native, but if it's blue, if it's really kind of a true blue, not purplish, but true blue, it's one of our natives, and it is perennial. It's perfectly hardy. It spreads like crazy. It grows from it's rhizomatous. That means its roots spread out. It puts up sprouts everywhere. It's a really cool thing to have in a pasture. It's a little more difficult to have in your yard. It can be difficult to work around, I'll tell you. Just difficult. It can be difficult to grow in your garden because it is so rhizomatous, but it's perfectly edible. And then there was a great blue passion flower, native passion flower that was in Spring Hill. And I used to ride my bike when I was riding my bike to work at the botanical gardens. I'd get up to the top of that hill, and it was a big climb. Did it okay, but you'd be a little tired. You want a break. And right there where I was having a break, there was this big, big blue passion flower. And I'd stop and eat the fruits because they were delicious. They're great when they mature. If you can get them when they're mature, they're really neat. And then I'd ride on to the botanical gardens. What a nice little stop. What a nice little place to stop. Of course, all that was cut down. It's all gone. They wanted to make the roadsides neat and golf course like in Spring Hill. So we lost those beautiful things and that beautiful fruit, that blue passion flower. Leave it in, if you got it in your pasture, leave it. It's beautiful. It's a nice thing. There's another one called the yellow passion flower. It's very important for a lot of creatures. You'll see it a lot in forest edges. It's got a small fruit. It too is edible. But yes, they're edible. They're great.
She's my pizza pie with lots.
All right.
With guguzza.
There, this is speaking of which, guguzza.
Is so crazy over me. Guguzza grows in Italy. They love it on the farm. It's something like zucchini flavored with Italian charm. I call my gal Guguzza cause she's sweet as she can be. She loves to hear me say, Guguzza, please, or botcha me. My Guguzza.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Welcome back, Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning, Mississippi Sunday morning. It's hot and beautiful. Look at that picture of this marsh that Rusty over Moss Point sent me with the Costaletskias, the southern seashore mallow. You know, we now know that one is a different species than we have in other places, and a lot of people think it's quite rare, Costaletskia pentacarpus. And probably restricted to a very narrow area. Very, very important to understand more about this southern seashore mallow. But it is very nice to see it along the Gulf Coast. And nice to see that picture. Beautiful thing. Hibiscus relative. It's in a different genus because it's a little different than a typical hibiscus, Costaletskia. Sorry for that. But I'm sure he's a nice guy, Costeletz. And he got named for him somehow. And so that's really good. Too late to plant tomatoes, Jerry? No, but you better have a plant ready to go. Do not plant from seed. I think it's too late to plant from seed now. You just got to have a plant ready to go right now. Otherwise, it's going to be a little bit late. I think it's going to be hard to deal with. Bill, let's try to do this tangerine. We may have to come back to it next week, but let's try to do it quick. We don't have a lot of time, but I'm listening.
Okay. Far away.
All right, so what do you want? Do you want to prune this thing?
No, I just want to get rid. You said you would advise me on how to get rid of the dead out of it. So,
yeah, so pruning it. So here's the thing: look for gently go back in with your with loppers, and you know what I'm talking about with the little short heads on them. Get you a nice pair.
Oh yeah,
with long handles. And,
got them.
And cut back in, and as long as it's dry wood, you can keep cutting back in, and cut back in until you get to wet wood. If you don't get to wet wood, but you overwhelm the loppers, get you a little saw, and do the same, and just keep taking that back until you get to wood that isn't looking dry, but looks like it's moist in the center. Does that make sense?
That does. It does. What about fertilization?
I wouldn't push the fertilization right now. You can do it next spring. If you push the fertilization right now, it will put out a lot of growth. And if we have another hard winter, it may not have time to harden off quite as well as you would like. You want citrus to put on as much growth as possible in spring. Summer growth and fall growth on citrus is always more vulnerable to cold because it's younger and more tender. So don't fertilize now. Fertilize in the spring.
All right.
All right, Bill. Call me back next week if you get run into any trouble. All right.
Thank you so much.
Gene. Yeah, thank you. Gene, what's going on?
Where are they going to? Hello?
You didn't get any?
No.
I don't know. I'm interested to see. I think some people did not have as big a year on figs as otherwise because I didn't get as many pictures. I did get some pictures. I don't know what to say about the figs this year. I don't think we can blame it on the rainfall. Maybe we can. I just don't know, Gene.
Well, two different things. One, I rooted about 4 years ago, and last year it didn't do much because I didn't count on doing much, and I figured it would do good this year. And I fertilized it in February, which may be wrong. It put on nice growth, beautiful, but there's 5, 6, 10 figs on it. And I had an older one that's been transplanted about 4 or 5 years ago, and it didn't have any on it. And I went to 2 or 3 places where I had some old vacant houses I used to pick figs from, and there wasn't none on those things. Where can I buy it? Do you have an idea?
No, sir. It's interesting. We ought to figure out how to
fix for us over with.
Yeah, I know. I know what you're saying. My figs didn't do toot this year either. I don't think I want to blame it on the cold, but it may have had some impact. I think fertilizing doesn't help. One of the problems with figs in our climate is that they grow too well.
Yeah.
And if they're happy and they're growing really well and they got plenty of moisture and they got plenty of fertilizer, then they're not going to pause to flower. And I've seen people not get figs. It frequently happens because they've basically over-fertilized. I have never fertilized a fig.
Well, I don't generally fertilize them either. That's an irony of it.
Yeah. So and fertilizing can actually reduce flowering, not because the fig's unhappy, but simply because the fig's saying, "Oh, I got plenty of energy here. I don't need to make babies. I'm not going to make flowers," and it won't make flowers. And it's the flowers that you eat.
But you can't eat the leaves.
That's right. That's right. Well, and I wouldn't rule that out, but I. it's not nearly as much fun as eating the fruits.
No, no. So, it's hard to count a leaf. But anyway.
Yeah, that's
anyway,
right.
I had to find that one. And I tell you what I used to put on mine. I used to work at plaster. And I would take that plaster, leftover plaster, and set up and pour around those trees and put that. It put at least that lime in the thing, and I always thought that made them do well, which it did, as far as I could tell. But it was in any merit to that?
Well, you know, I don't know that lime helps. It could help a little bit. The way I do figs is very simple. The only thing I do to figs is pile leaves around them, and
that's
they love
right.
it. And it makes a huge difference. And if we had another hour, I could tell you why it makes a difference. But it makes a huge difference. And I'm talking about you put those leaves as far around that fig as you can, put them on as thick as you like. It'll love it. It
yeah.
reduces the nematode problems. It improves the soil. It provides all the nutrients that fig needs. And it's perfect. It just works out real well. And
yeah.
that's the big thing. But I wouldn't do anything else. The rain may have had, we don't want to blame everything on the rain. Maybe the rain had something to do with the fix.
Well,
the
weather's so crazy. When it got like on my citrus, it come out, got cold, it stayed warm a long time, and then all of a sudden you thought it was gone, and it come along, knocked all my blooms off my lemon tree, so I don't have it. All the leaves fell off, so I knew it was over with then. So it was just kind of that late little cold spell, I think, may have had some bearing on it. I don't know.
But I'm glad to find out somebody's having trouble. Yeah. I haven't seen a lot. We all personalize our fig tree issues, but I haven't looked at a lot of other figs. And so I'll have to say, listen, folks, we got a week to think about this. You tell me how your figs did and call in next week. Let Gene and me know
right.
how your figs did. Right.
And then we'll know.
Yeah, and then we'll know it wasn't our fault. So if everybody else had problems with figs, and then I'll have to figure out what in the world the problem was. I don't know. Maybe the rain. Maybe if it's, but we don't know that it's a pervasive problem yet. It may be just that Gene and I did something wrong. Okay. So let's listen out. Let's think about it. And I did not have time to figure out what this mushroom is, Ted, but I'm going to know next week if you want to send it to me again, and I'll tell you. It's pretty sure it's Amanita. Pretty sure it's toxic. I'm sure it's toxic. Don't eat it. Hey, we're going to be back next week. Get your cool season stuff ready to go.
Along about 1825, I left Tennessee very much alive. And I never would have got through the Arkansas mud if I hadn't been a-ruttin' that Tennessee stud. I had some trouble.